episode 67, Patrick and Cyprian speak with Ramon Arroz, co-founder and chief scientific officer at Multiverse Computing. The team discuss industry applications of quantum software, material science, artificial intelligence, and the future of quantum disruptions. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Hey Cyprian, how are you doing today?
Hi Patrick, I'm doing well and looking forward for another great episode of Entangled Things.
As usual, we will not disappoint. Roman's joining us. Roman, could you mind introducing yourself to our audience?
Yeah, so hi everybody, I'm Roman Arroz. I'm the co-founder and also chief scientific officer of Multiverse Computing. I'm a physicist, more than 20 years working on quantum technologies. I did my PhD a long time ago, actually, in Barcelona. Then I've been working in many places. I work in Australia. I work at the Max Planck Institute. I was a professor of condensed matter physics in Germany. And now I'm a research professor also here in Spain and also an entrepreneur building quantum software companies.
Very, very cool. So we're very interested in all of that, but the one that piques my interest the most is Multiverse and what you guys are doing. Are you working on a specific adiabatic programming with things like D-Wave, or are you open to universal gate programming? What's your focus?
Yeah, so at Multiverse, we do quantum software for industry, okay? So we don't do hardware, we do the software part, okay? And we do software that has immediate industry applications, okay? Now, from the perspective of the hardware, we are completely agnostic. It means that we build applications and quantum algorithms that use any type of available quantum computer. Essentially, we have partnerships with everybody who has a quantum computer and gives access to it, okay? And then also from the software point of view, something that we are obsessed with is, staying very close to the end user, okay? We have the feeling that many quantum companies around somehow, they are too academic, okay? And in our case, we started putting always the client first, trying to understand exactly what was the problem of the client, and then reverse engineering until we are able to solve the problem with quantum tools, okay? And we started with finance. The company started 4 years ago in 2019. And we started in finance because that's exactly the thing that we knew better, how to apply quantum computing for finance. But last year in 2022, we decided to expand our solutions to other industry verticals. And then we started working, for instance, in energy, in manufacturing, in logistics, in cybersecurity, in chemistry, and so on.
I would think that chemistry would be the one most anxious to get into the action, and some of the others would have to be convinced on why quantum. Are you seeing a lot of demand, or are you having to educate a lot of people on how quantum is going to disrupt their industry?
Yeah, actually, there is something interesting going on here, because chemistry is kind of the most, textbook application of a quantum computer, okay? Obviously, if you want to simulate a molecule, or if you want to simulate a material, also in material science. These are made of atoms, and atoms are quantum systems, and therefore you need a quantum computer to properly simulate this, no? And this looks like a very basic and straightforward application, but turns out to be one of the hardest ones, actually. So for solving chemistry problems, we actually need quantum computers that are much more powerful than what we have today, okay? What we have today are quantum computers with a small number of qubits. They are also noisy, and the type of algorithms that we can run there, you cannot solve everything with the current quantum computers, but you can start doing things. For instance, you can start doing optimization problems, you can start improving machine learning and artificial intelligence, and so on. And then once you realize this, you notice that you can go to many industry verticals. Okay, so for instance, right now we are finding most of the activity in our company is in energy, manufacturing, and finance right now, especially energy. Energy companies, they have lots of hard computational problems, okay? But they also have this problem that, we have to go carbon neutral, we have to look for more efficient models of computation, okay, that spend less energy, and that's exactly where quantum computing actually enters.
Yeah you definitely, you're focusing on very interesting topics. I saw on your website you're working to make AI more, less computationally intensive. Is that AI is Cyprian's area as well, big data and AI. Can you tell us more about how that's working? Is it, are you working with specific companies?
Yeah, so you know, AI as it is today, it's not sustainable. I mean, when you all know all this mess about generative AI, ChatGPT, large language models, and so on. No? I mean, if you go and ask ChatGPT about anything, it's amazing the type of answers that they give you. But the problem is that, you know, the last version of ChatGPT, which is ChatGPT-4, I think that training that system, it was 100 million in electricity bill. Okay. So obviously that's not sustainable. There is a huge computational barrier there in traditional machine learning approaches. It means that we are doing something bad because, you know, kids learn to speak and we don't need to burn the planet to teach a kid to speak. Okay. So there are more efficient ways. Okay. And that's actually where quantum computing and also quantum inspired computing, which is also something that we do at Multiverse Centers. Okay. So with quantum computers, we are able to reduce the training time. Okay. We can also detect the same type of anomalies in the data with less data, okay, and therefore increase the precision of the calculations, and we can also improve a lot the memory consumption of the training. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's amazing. So this is just going to keep going. I've seen, not to branch into AI too much, is exactly what you're saying, that the next model is probably very likely not around the corner. Because not only is there not sufficient data to train the models that hasn't been used, quality data, but it also, as you said, it's probably the next model would have to be an order of magnitude bigger than the last model, and it becomes too expensive to do. I guess the question then are you guys working to try to bring that timeline in? Is there some, or are there other challenges in AI that you see quantum being able to attack first?
Yeah, so I think that's the most important one, okay? The fact that the way that in which we are doing AI, well, it works up to a certain point, okay? And it can give you impressive results, but it's definitely not the way that nature is working, because nature is not using so much energy to do a calculation, okay? So we are definitely doing something wrong, okay? There are more efficient ways of dealing with information. And one, for instance, has to do with all these quantum-inspired methods. This is actually something very interesting. You know, quantum-inspired methods, these are algorithms and machine learning algorithms that run on your classical computer, but they are inspired by how a quantum computer actually mimics, processes information, right? It's kind of a byproduct of quantum computing. This is also something very interesting. You know, over the years, people and researchers, they have been working on understanding better quantum systems and developing quantum software and so on. And then, they produce quantum algorithms, but on top of that, they also improve the classical algorithms, okay? And these are the quantum expert algorithms that we are nowadays using and so on. And these methods, they are much, much more efficient than traditional deep learning. Much, much more efficient, okay? I mean, the guys from Google, for instance, they are starting to do that. The guys from Amazon AWS. We were the first ones to implement that in industry, actually in finance, okay, with a lot of success. And this is, I don't know if this is the way to go, but this is definitely one way to go, okay, to reduce the energy consumption of all these.
When I first heard about quantum many, many years ago, there was a conference, and the people who I were talking to said that when they took a problem from the classical world and recast it as a quantum program, they were finding an 8% gain even when running it on classical computing, just because of the way they reimagined the problem. Now, maybe that's because they got a second chance to do better and not make the same mistakes. But there's also the concept that if a problem has five solutions and you just take the first one that you think of, there's only a 20% chance it's going to be the most efficient. So by thinking about problems in different ways, we're going to come across a lot of efficiencies there. Have you seen it consistently better when we think about it in quantum, or is it kind of like a normal spread that you would expect?
It depends on the problem. So current quantum solutions, they are particularly, I mean, once we have a quantum computer that is error-free and with millions of qubits and so on, we are going to be able to solve everything, okay?
Right.
But the first applications that we see that we can use, for which we see that we can use today's quantum computers, which are limited, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this has to do with problems that, relate to optimization, for instance, minimizing the amount of traffic jams, okay? in Beijing, for instance, or optimizing the energy market or optimizing a finance portfolio. And then everything that has to do with machine learning, that's definitely one of those things that a quantum computer nowadays, even though they are still kind of preliminary, you can already start to, to find applications that are useful, and they are useful for industry. I mean, I'm not saying here things that are related to academic toy model problems. No, I'm talking here about real data problems that the companies have on their everyday life. I mean, for instance, one example is artificial vision. Okay, this is a typical problem in machine learning. Okay, where you have to train a computer to recognize faces, let's say, or to recognize patterns or detect defects. Okay, on a picture. So it turns out that you can improve the precision of these systems with a quantum computer. With a quantum computer today.
Really? Because
we've done it. We've done it a couple of times. We've been working with Bosch, for instance, and also with Ikerlang, which is another manufacturing company here in Spain, on image recognition systems. And the two pilot projects, they actually work really very well.
So I'm curious here, what is the approach that you're taking? What part of the problem do you embed in a quantum computer from the image vision that provides that lift in performance?
Yeah, in the case of these pilot projects, we had to decide whether it was a problem in manufacturing where we had to detect defects in manufactured pieces. Okay, and the way to detect that was from pictures. You know, they just took pictures of the pieces, and you had to detect from the image whether it was broken or not. Essentially, no. This is a classification problem in machine learning. Essentially, it's a binary classification. There is an error or not, okay? And then you can train the system and so on. And that's the approach that we took, in this case.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things that we've constantly hearing is the problem of getting data into quantum systems. So you need to kind of like shift your problem, shift your view of the problem so that you don't need to embed a lot of data, because with current quantum computers, obviously, that is extremely, extremely difficult, right?
Yeah, it depends very much on the method that you choose. So it's true that there are some quantum machine learning algorithms where you have to embed the data in a quantum state, and that's the input to the quantum system, and you process it and so on. But fortunately, there are other quantum machine learning algorithms where you don't have to embed the data in the quantum computer. I mean, they work exactly as the neural networks, for instance, that you have to optimize a series of parameters of the network to minimize an error function, right? And you are not embedding the data in the system. You are just putting that in the error function, okay? So with the current type of algorithms that we are using, that's exactly what we are doing. We have some sort of variational quantum computation where we optimize the parameters of the quantum computer to minimize the error of the output. Yeah. And in this way here, the data is not a problem, because you deal with it exactly in the same way as you would be dealing with neural networks, for instance.
So what kind of hardware does that use? Are you using some kind of adiabatic quantum computing hardware for that? Because I presume that's a variational eigensolver, the one that you're talking about, right?
Yeah, we have different approaches. I mean, we use variational quantum eigensolvers, for instance, and these run on universal quantum computers, the ones that are programmed using the gate-based model, for instance, the one by IBM, the one by Google, the one by IonQ, and so on. But then we also use D-Wave. Okay, D-Wave is a quantum annealer, and it has a completely different approach. D-Wave is not a universal quantum computer. It's a quantum computer that only solves one problem, which is minimizing a classical cost function, and that's it. And it turns out that there are ways of mapping machine learning algorithms to optimization problems that you can solve with D-Wave, and that's exactly how we are dealing with it.
Very, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to see, and that's where we're always happy to have guests who are doing, even within the constraints of the hardware that exists today, right, who are doing work that is closer to real life. Because I honestly, we all know the examples with the 5 qubits and doing all sorts of small problems, very small scale problems with those 5 qubits. But addressing the more, let's say, real world problems, it's very interesting. What is like how how would you describe the appetite of real life organizations, businesses, right, for adopting even at early stages as we are now, quantum computing solutions or quantum based solutions? Is there like a lot of education that you need to do, a lot of explaining? Do you see, on the contrary, people are like embarking? Because Patrick has this very interesting theory, which I fully agree with, which says that basically Shor has done more to quantum computing, like the Shor algorithm, because it secured funding for the field virtually for an unlimited period of time, right? But we need to kind of move past the Shor discussion. And the fact that you're doing already stuff in optimization seems to me very encouraging. That's why I was asking, like, how would you characterize the interaction with these organizations? Because for sure, quantum is something very new to them, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But it's also true that in the last years, especially big corporations and organizations, they are starting to organize. I mean, they, 5 years ago or so, they didn't see it so close, let's say. Nowadays, all big organizations, they start to have their own quantum teams because they realize that, this is a technology that is going to come. It's not an option. Okay. And we are better prepared, because if we are not prepared, our competitors are going to be, and then we are going to lose any competitive advantage. They cannot miss, no?
The train. Either disruptor be disrupted.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly what is happening. For instance, we see this very clearly with banks. All big banks nowadays, they have their own quantum programs inside of the bank. Okay. So they started by, identifying who inside of the bank was a physicist and knew something about quantum. And they started to build their own quantum teams and identifying which problems will be relevant and exploring the technology and so on. But the same is happening in energy companies. The same is happening in manufacturing companies and so on. We are seeing this more and more. Yeah.
Yeah. We've had some guests that were working with big companies that you wouldn't expect to have a quantum practice. But there, everybody understands. If you think about it, we're still down in the, hundreds of qubits. Imagine doing this much with hundreds of bits. I mean, cool. I can't, you could do a calculator program and maybe a shopping list with classical bits if you only had 100 of them. But you're doing real science. You're doing real things. And I don't know if that's informed by what came before, or it's just a preview of how much more powerful a qubit's going to be in impacting our ability to leverage them. So when we have millions of error-free qubits, as you described, which I'm sure will eventually happen, I don't know that we can predict how far-reaching that will be.
No, I absolutely agree. I always say that we know, when people ask me about what are the implications of quantum computing and why a quantum computer is actually useful, I always say that, we know that the computer is going to be able to solve this and this and this and this problem, okay, which are relevant for what we have today. But the actual important application of a quantum computer, we still don't know it, okay, because right. For that, the first thing that we need is a 1 million quantum computer. 1 million qubit quantum computer, okay, that is working error-free and so on. And then somebody will work out an application that right now we cannot imagine. This is like, I always make the same analogy. This is like going to the 1930s and telling Alan Turing, who was the father of classical computing, telling that, hey, this machine that you are building here, we are going to use it to build something called Twitter, okay? So
yeah,
that I can share news with my friends. And so that was probably the last thing that he had in mind, okay? So
yeah.
Nowadays, social networks.
Or to build a GPU, for that matter.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think with quantum computers, the same thing is going to happen. So we know what we can do with a quantum computer today. But the real true application of a quantum computer, we will not know it until it's here with us and we are just getting used to use it and we'll understand what this machine is actually useful.
You know, there is that half joke, half truth that says, what will be the first quantum computer be used for to build the second one?
Yes.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Which is not that far. But
I think that's
along
true.
along these lines... what is your opinion on how do you see the evolution of the modalities of building these machines? Could we definitely have the two that appear to be the most popular, the trapped ions and the superconducting ones? But we also see a lot of discussion around some other approaches, even ones that bring us maybe closer to room temperature and things like that, with potential disruption in there. How do you see the evolution of hardware? Because it's a very important aspect if we are looking to have like working quantum computers, especially ones where error correction actually works.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is actually a very interesting discussion. So you know, as of today, we still don't know how a quantum computer is going to be built in the long term. This is why there are so many hardware approaches. No, there are many different ways of building a quantum computer, in the same way that there are also many different ways of building a classical computer. But nowadays we are doing it with microelectronics because somebody invented the transistor, okay, and made it scalable. Okay, so right now with quantum computers, we need the analog of the transistor. We need whatever thing, I still don't know what it is, that makes this technology scalable. So it allows us to go from several dozens or hundreds of qubits to millions. Okay, we still don't have that. Now, what happens with the technology that we have today? So ion traps, for instance, they are very difficult to scale. Okay, but there are some proposals out there and people are working very hard. It looks like superconducting qubits, such as the thing that IBM and Google are doing, and Rigetti, you know. This is a technology that is easier to scale, all right, but it also has other problems. Neutral atoms, okay, so there are people here such as Pascal, for instance, that, this is a technology that is also very promising. And then coming to room temperature, I think the photonic quantum computing is also quite promising. But as of today, I think that there is no particular type of technology that is ahead of the others. Maybe superconducting qubits, but not so much, right? So I don't know. I think we'll have to wait and see what the future is going to bring.
We might still be in the vacuum tube days, and none of the things that we're using today will be what they use in the future.
Yeah, probably the technology that we'll end up using, it will have nothing to do with all this. That's also my bet. Yeah.
we've seen that happen, right, with the history of classical computing. I would also like to maybe understand a little bit more on the software stack that you are building. Like, how close do you get to the quantum computer itself, and how far do you get from it? Like, what is the type of integration that you're building on top of this? Because being hardware agnostic is a non-trivial task, absolutely, today, right? With the multitude of types of hardware that there are out there.
Absolutely. So what we are building is actually a middleware. Okay. So we are building a product, mm-hmm, that is called Singularity. Okay. And Singularity is a middleware between the user and the hardware. Now, depending on the problem that the user wants to solve, Singularity chooses one hardware or another. Okay. And it connects to the quantum computer on the cloud and makes all the calculations there. Now, what is also very important for us is to make the solution simple to the user. You know, we are developing very advanced quantum and quantum-inspired algorithms to solve all these problems related to optimization, machine learning, in real use cases, no, such as machine vision and so on. But we are making it trivial to the end user. You know, the end user is not a quantum scientist. The end user is anybody. Okay, and you don't need a PhD in quantum computing to, you shouldn't need a PhD on quantum computing to run a quantum solution.
Okay? And they don't want one.
And they don't want one, exactly, because they are working on something else.
They got enough to do.
Exactly. And this is why we are obsessed also with making the solutions easy. For instance, something that we did in finance, okay, for different finance apps, we noticed that many people in finance, they work with Excel. Okay, Microsoft Excel with the spreadsheets. Okay, they download the data from Bloomberg and so on, and then you can even program in Microsoft Excel, so it can be as complicated as you want. So what we did was a plugin for Microsoft Excel to actually solve finance problems with a quantum computer. And you know, the guy working at the bank just downloads the plugin, installs it, and you see there is a menu and so on. It puts the data, runs, and gets the results, and he or she doesn't know what is going on, but gets an answer. And what is happening behind is that, you know, the system is connecting to a quantum computer, solving the problem and so on, and then giving back the solution in a friendly way. Okay. So this is key. This is the key. Okay. So we also noticed that many people, of course it's important that the end user knows something about quantum, but at the end of the day, the end user shouldn't know anything about quantum. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is our philosophy, that we need to make quantum computing
transparent.
For everyone. You have to democratize it. Okay.
Yeah. So that way, like, I don't have to know how a fuel injector works to drive a car.
Exactly. It's the same example. I just want to use it. That's it.
Right. Yeah. I think we're still a long ways from that. I think, especially when we get to programming, I think there is a, when we have people who are trying to solve problems, they still have to understand the physics, superposition, you know, things like that, entanglement, in order to build the solutions to not just the hardware, but to program against D-Wave and things like that. Do you think that'll eventually go away and programmers will have to not understand the weirdness of qubits in order to
That's the way to go. That's what we are trying to do. That's what we are trying to do. I mean, at this moment, you know, all this programming is very low level. You have to be very close to the actual quantum processor, know how it works and so on. But we are building solutions so that programmers or, let's say, end users, they don't need to know anything about quantum. Okay?
That'd be awesome. So it's an abstraction layer because we think that you're in education. We're probably not going to get 100 million people to understand quantum at the fundamental level, to the level we would need to if it stays the way it is.
Exactly.
So what you're doing is exactly what is necessary for the market to be able to grow. Otherwise, we become resource constrained at the human resources level.
Yep, exactly. And also from a company perspective, it makes much more sense because suddenly the market it expands exponentially. Right. So if you only do software for quantum experts, you know, how many quantum experts are out there working at a manufacturing company? Not so many, okay?
Yeah.
But if you do software for everybody, then anybody can be your market. And it just makes sense.
So I presume part of your work, like working on this abstraction, is clearly having in your organization people that have this deep understanding of things. How do you see the human resource availability in this particular field? Because, like, it's clear abstraction is the way to go, but still we will need to have the companies that will build the abstraction. And we've been hearing that there is a non-trivial shortage in terms of folks who are really understanding these things at a level that is deep enough to be able to build up those stacks. So long story short, my question is, do you think we will have enough people to build up this kind of stack of abstractions, or we have a problem there as well?
That's a very good question. So we right now, there is a war for talent in the quantum space. So, you know, the quantum companies, they are fighting with each other to attract the best talent because it's scarce. There are few people that actually know about quantum software and quantum programming, and even fewer people that know about Quantum Inspired, which is a sub-community of quantum, no? And there's really, you know, a shortage. But luckily, there are more and more master programs, PhD programs, and so on quantum science going on internationally, right? But it's true. We are going to need more people coming out from academic institutions being educated on quantum, and not just in physics. I mean, also in computer science, for instance, in engineering, and so on.
Yeah, that's going to be a big challenge. That's the reason for this podcast. I'm in cybersecurity, Cyprian's in big data AI, and when we both are rabidly interested in quantum, but it's neither one of our core business. So we want the podcast to help inform. So is there anything on the horizon for Multiverse that you're that you want to share or that we should be paying attention to? Are you guys speaking at any events? Do you guys attend or run any conferences? What should we be telling people about the company?
Oh, you should be telling people that we are the largest quantum software company in Europe, okay? And the second largest in the world after Sandbox, actually. So,
wow. You know,
Sandbox, yeah. So we are 87 people already. And we have been growing very, very fast. And our plan is to double or even multiply by 3 the size of the company in the next year and year and a half. Yeah. So
you're making Cyprian happy. He likes Europe dominate in quantum.
Yeah. We have many projects going on. We have revenues, and I think that the it's going very well for us because we had this approach from the very beginning that we have to be very close to the end user. Okay, this was fundamental for us. And now it's paying off. Actually, you know, the reason why we are expanding so much is because the clients understand our approach and they want to work with us. So yeah, we are going to be growing a lot in the next years. Yeah.
Excellent.
And one of the things that always kind of is on my mind is how, because we're just starting to see the what I call the quantum-born generations, right? The ones who are literally coming out of school by like learning quantum first. What are some of the difficulties that you see with folks who have like background in classical computing in kind of starting to grasp the quantum part? Like there is one field which where clearly the two need to mix, which is quantum inspired, because you like need to be like very good in both. And as you said, that's kind of a small subset, right? That's like the la crème de la crème, so to speak. But like in general, what I see is quite a number of people who not even, maybe don't even want to do like create a new algorithm or whatever. But if you already have a background in classical computing, a lot of the stuff that is related, especially to kind of the algorithms, like trying to explain something like, say, amplitude amplification, right, to someone who has a background in computer science proves to be extremely difficult because they are biased. Yeah. Patterns coming from classical, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I've actually been teaching quantum computing to computer scientists, and I noticed that they are so used to the classical rules that it's very hard for them to think out of the box. You start telling them, well, you know, now this is not a variable, it's a vector, and you have superposition and this and that. And they say, at the beginning, they say, oh, yeah, it's very clear. Yeah. But then they start to see the implications and they don't understand anything. And it's a challenge. So, yeah.
We've had one guest that we liked very much because of the message that he was like sending out to the world. He was teaching quantum computing to high school kids. Obviously, like the simplest introduction, well, if there is anything simple in quantum, but the introductory notions. And I think that's extremely important because we need to start, and I fully agree with what you said, we need to start educating more and more. And we see, like, we already see those master degree programs and things like that. What I would really like to see, and hopefully we're not far from that day, is where I would see, like, an entire curricula, like, kind of end to end being quantum without even touching some of the classical things. Because what they try to do today, and that's kind of like why I asked the previous question, a lot of the stuff that they try to do today in universities is kind of reverse engineer folks or kind of move folks from, they start with classical and then they go ahead and try to provide some quantum concepts, right? Yeah. I very much look forward for that quantum-born generation because if you look at what we've had in the last decades, there are not many new Shor algorithms or not many new Grover algorithms and things like that. So at this fundamental level, kind of have the feeling that things are a little bit stalled in terms of discovering the next big things in quantum algorithms, for example.
Well, do you think that... was Grover a mathematician the way Shor was? Because maybe you need mathematicians to come up with these algorithms. That's something that occurred to me.
I think he was a computer. He's a computer scientist, I think.
Okay, so there's some hope there. Because if they're both mathematicians, then we might have to look to the mathematicians for our algorithms.
Yeah.
No one wants that.
Well, we'll see. We need people that think out of the box, definitely.
Yeah. Exactly, right. Yeah. I don't know anybody who learned quantum computing before classical, and I do wonder about whether it makes it, it's more obvious. Oh yeah, that makes sense because it's such a juxtaposition. You have to like, oh no, it doesn't work the same way as what you understand. I'm definitely interested. We should probably talk to that guest and see if we can, you know, talk to his class sometime and ask them about.
Oh, that would be awesome. Do like a small online quiz. So without kind of getting into any areas that you would want to comment, but kind of Patrick raised this to me, I always cheer because I'm based in Romania. I'm from Europe, right? So I always cheer when I see initiatives in fields that are close to my heart, like AI, machine learning, and quantum computing. when I see European initiatives kind of taking over, companies being successful, like, how do you see like the balance of let's say, quantum knowledge and quantum power in terms of geographical distribution?
That's a good point. I mean, obviously there is a lot of quantum talent in Europe, okay, as there is also in the US. I mean, right now the biggest, let's say, geopolitical regions working on quantum, they are obviously North America, okay, US, Canada, Europe, China. And but in terms of, I mean, in academia, Europe is very, very strong, okay? But in startup companies and so on, Europe, well, we have to admit that, you know, entrepreneurship is not a European thing, okay? So it's when you compare it to the US, you just have to see the number of unicorns that they are popping out there and the number of unicorns that are popping up in Europe. And I think it's an educational thing. It's just the way that Europeans are, probably. They are not so eager to risk, let's say, okay, or something like this. And it's a pity. I think that in industry right now, especially the US and Canada, they are leading the way, okay, in hardware. When it comes to software, there is kind of a tie. It's not so clear, okay, because there are also there are both companies in the US and Canada and also in Europe that are very, very strong. Okay, so we'll see. And then, of course, there is China, which is a separate thing, okay, that they are doing their own thing. And that's
a little bit of a black box.
Yeah, I'm curious what your perspective that I've had over the years with China is that it's government, it's basically government backed. And it's also focused very much on the communication more than anything else, so the military applications more than anything else.
Yeah.
Am I wrong? Is there a vibrant, system in China where they're trying to apply it to business problems? I just haven't seen any indications of that.
We don't know. I mean, probably they have quantum computers as powerful as the one by IBM. This I can imagine. So I know that they have been publishing papers and studies with quantum computers with more than 100 qubits and so on. So probably they have around 500 or so like IBM. Okay. But we don't know what they are doing in industry. We don't really know. We have no idea. Yeah. Hmm. I mean, obviously, they are having lots of applications in defense, in sensors, in communications, satellite-based communication, actually, with quantum channels. But in industry applications of quantum computing, we don't know. We don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, we've ranged our topics quite wide, across the whole planet, actually. We're getting close on time. Been an excellent conversation. We're very interested in what you're doing. Is there anything else we should talk about before we wrap up?
Stay tuned because we are going to grow a lot. Yeah.
You're definitely a company to watch. We will be Absolutely. Watching you, and hopefully we'll have you back on the show sometime in the near future.
Yeah. Excellent.
Thanks to everybody. Thanks, Cyprian. We'll see you guys later.
Thank you. This has been an excellent conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Thank
you. Goodbye.